and welcome to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball with you. We are back from the All-Star break. This is, you know, we timed this quite well. We recorded literally as the last games before the All-Star break were finishing up. We are now recording as the first games after the All-Star break are starting up. That is Friday night, the 19th. Games are just getting going. But Pete, how was your All-Star break?
My All-Star break was fine. We were just talking about this off the air, but I had a little bit of a bout with COVID for like the 30th time in my life. But here I am coming out the other side. And I'm facing, so as folks know, I'm a big head-to-head categories guy, and I'm facing Trey Turner in my favorite league. So it was like getting my ass beat by Trey Turner, and then it was like a four-day break, and then he just right away tonight just started smoking me again. So it's been a nice break from Trey Turner that has ended tonight.
Well, I'm glad you enjoyed that break while you had it.
Hey, Jaren Duran, right? Jaren Duran.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He had a great All-Star game.
He did.
Yeah. As a Cleveland fan, Class A had that nasty, nasty ninth inning. But I also, I was a little worried. I'd been getting more and more worried about David Fry, and then was like, sort of excited for him being an All-Star, right? It's great that he gets to be an All-Star, but he has not been good for a while. And then he got a hit in the All-Star game.
Heck yeah.
And I was like, oh, maybe this will get him going. And today he was 3-for-3 with a walk, scored a couple runs, drove in a run.
We're back, now, baby.
I think one of those was like a hard hit ground ball that basically bounced off Manny Machado. The other was like a grounder. But hey, hits are hits.
Yeah.
Get going. So yeah, I feel good about that. But we are on now to episode 144 of the Keeper Cup podcast. And after last week, I commented on how like we're reaching the numbers where like, you know, it gets less interesting. There's a guy, he didn't go by Henry Aaron. He went by Hank more often than not, but he wore number 44 and he had a good career. He was a good player. Pretty decent.
You said his name was Aaron Henry. Was that it?
Yeah, Hank Aaron, I think he predates us, predates our fantasy playing. I think he predates the existence of fantasy. If you ever find yourself in a time machine and are back in the 50s or 60s, you should draft him for fantasy. I think he'd be good. But even though he wasn't really around for the fantasy era, I still have a hard time. There's some other good 44s. Reggie Jackson worked for 11 years, Willie McCovey for 22. But if you add the career war for Reggie Jackson to the career war for Willie McCovey, who are the second and third best players to have worn this number, you still end up like more than an MVP season short of where Hank Aaron ended up. So yeah, I think Hank gets this one.
Yeah, for sure. A lot of good names there, but there's no debate for this episode.
Yeah. So we usually at this point would go into our head-to-head heroes. We're not going to do that this week, mostly because, as we said, our last episode recorded just as baseball is wrapping up for the All-Star break. We are now recording just as baseball is getting started again after the All-Star break. Nobody did anything to get to be a hero. I guess we could pick like our All-Star game heroes, but you already mentioned Duran. I already mentioned Classe and Fry. So I think we've covered that. But what we did do is we put out a call for questions. We actually asked the people at trades they wanted us to discuss. Nobody really has trades they want us to discuss. What they do have are players are thinking about trading. Players are trying to figure out how to value some strategy questions, questions about how we use projections. There's a lot of really interesting stuff in here. And so we are going to power through. Let's see. We've got 7 questions on here. That gives us, you know, 5 to 10 minutes per question. I think we can get through all 7. I think we can do it, Pete.
Yeah, no problem. 7. We could get through like 10 minimum.
Ooh.
Maybe I'll think of 3.
No. Well, you could think of questions if you want, but while you're thinking, let's dive into the first one. It comes from Jeff on Twitter. And Jeff, this is our first of, I think, 3 straight questions about first baseman. A lot of questions about first baseman this year. I think that's not, I don't know, given what I'm dealing with my first baseman, it's like, I have a number of them who are underperforming. I have some less expensive first baseman who are performing. There's guys like Cassis, who's been out, Christian Encarnacion Strand, who's been out, like a lot of people, I think, struggling with first base at some level. And Jeff's question is, what are your thoughts on a $31 Matt Olson rest of season? Would you try to trade for a cheaper Naylor, Walker, or other 1B, or have faith he will turn it on in the second half? Jeff, I will start by saying I'm feeling your pain. I have Olson in a couple of places, and, you know, I won't say he's sinking my teams, but he's certainly not helping them. So, Pete, what are your thoughts on this question, this $31 Matt Olson?
Yeah. So in long-term leagues, I'm not ready to be like done with Matt Olson, right? If you've got him in a dynasty league or something like that, I don't think I'm looking to sell this low. I think he's still going to be a very productive player for the next 3 to 4 years. So I'm not like out on Matt Olson. However, there are a lot of concerning signs. Like, first of all, yeah, he's underperforming his expected WOBA. His WOBA is 311. His expected WOBA is only 326. It's not that much better. You look at, you know, the Statcast stuff across the board is down, but what's concerning about Matt Olson is like the plate discipline gains that he's shown on a pretty consistent basis since 2020 have, in 2020, they were really bad and they started getting better after that. They're kind of gone. That strikeout rate is back up to 27%, which, if he's not going to hit the ball as hard as he's been hitting it the last two seasons, then he can't afford to also start striking out more, because that BABIP is going to go down as well. And so, I mean, you look at his strikeout rate by month. It's not like, you know, we're looking at the second half. Who cares what he did in the first half? It's, are we going to get something out of Matt Olson in the second half? Well, it's just not trending well. Strikeout rate in May, 26%. In June, 29%. In July, it's up to 30%. With a, by the way, a WRC plus of 42. He mysteriously can't hit righties this year at all. His WRC plus against righties this season is down to, this is staggering. His WRC plus in the season against righties is 83. I don't know what's going on with Matt Olson. And obviously, as everybody knows, Acuna is out for the season. The Braves are still in it. The offense is still not like one that I'd stream against, especially with Austin Riley hitting again. But I guess that's my long-winded way of saying I still like Matt Olson, but I wouldn't expect much out of him in the second half. So if you're going for it, yeah, I mean, I might prefer Josh Naylor at this point, but a cheap Josh Naylor, you're going to pay out the nose for that. So, like, are you sacrificing the rest of your team to upgrade from Naylor to, or from Matt Olson to Naylor? Because Matt Olson could, if he just randomly decides to start hitting again, be better than both Naylor and Walker in the second half. So that's quite a conundrum, but I just think it's going to cost too much to get those upgrades. You're kind of just stuck with Olson.
Yeah, and I think, you know, it's interesting that he mentioned those two guys, because I went to poke around at the hitter list on Pitcher List. A friend of the show, Scott Chu, posts that every week. He just posted one a couple days ago to get ready for the second half of the season. He has a comment on Matt Olson that he had mentioned in the past that the trends on Olson, it's all the stuff you were talking about, had made him nervous. There's a lack of results. And, you know, he commented like, look, he's got the upside. He's, you know, could he lead the National League in home runs in the second half? Sure. He has that kind of upside and talent. That said, upside will only take you so far. He then puts Olson at 34th on his hitter list. Now, 34th is not bad. No. Right. This is in a 12 team league. That's a late third round pick. Like that's still a valuable player. But what's interesting is the question here was, would you go after a cheap Walker or Naylor? He has Olson 34th. He has Walker 35th. He has Naylor 26th on this list. That's not the only list. It's also not a list. Like it's a 5x5 list. It's not an auto new or a points list, but it gives you a sense of where those guys are valued. And I do think, like, so where I've been looking at this closest is my CBS head-to-head league, where I have Olson as my first baseman. We have a corner infield spot and a util spot in that one. And I am set at the corners because I have both Rafael Devers and Jose Ramirez.
They're pretty good.
But Olsen, like here, the players I have on my team that qualify at first base are David Fry, who's also my only catcher, so he's staying there. Olsen, Spencer Steer, who I use all over the place, and Spencer Horwitz, who I mostly use at middle infield, if at all. I do think in that league, I am going to go look for another first baseman. And the reason for that is I have such an expensive Olsen that I probably can't keep him for next year at this point. And I think you are, man, a $31 Matt Olsen that this guy's talking about in and out of new league that Jeff asked about is getting borderline because the way he's hitting right now, that's a lot of risk to take on. I think I'm probably still keeping him at $33 next year, especially if he shows signs of life in the second half. In this CBS league, I have a $38 Olsen. It's a little bit of a lower salary cap league. And so that $38 is more than it sounds like if you're used to auto new prices. And I don't think I'm going to end up keeping that Olsen. And so I'm going to go find myself another first baseman if I can. Because if Olsen does turn it around, I'll play Olsen. I have a first base spot, third base spot, a corner spot, and a util spot. So I could play Olsen, another first baseman, and my two third base studs every day. Great. If he doesn't turn it around, once we start the playoffs in that head-to-head league, players who are dropped can be picked up by other teams, but they can't be kept. If Olsen isn't hitting better by the time the playoffs start, I'll end up dropping him to be able to use that cap space to stream pitchers, to pick up guys who are hot in the postseason, whatever. And so I do think it's worth going and looking for another first baseman. That said, as you noted, like you want to go get a cheap Naylor. Like I have some cheap Josh Naylor because I've been a fan of Naylor forever, as listeners of the show know. It's going to take a lot to pry him away from me. And the problem for a team that's contending is if I'm a team that's contending, I might trade a cheap Naylor if you give me a stud first baseman to replace him and an upgrade at another position or two. If I'm not competing, I'm not trading you that Naylor. There's not a trade that's going to make sense for me because he's already so good and cheap. So go get Naylor if you can. I just don't think you can. Now, what I would do in an auto new league is, or as I said, in the league I'm in, is go trade for an overpriced Vlad. Go trade for an overpriced Freddie Freeman or Pete Alonso, who we're about to talk about those two guys and other questions. Like, go trade for those guys, knowing you're not going to keep them, knowing that they'll come a little bit cheaper because they're not keepers, because they haven't necessarily been great, as great as people hoped, I guess. If they both hit, like if Olsen turns it around, fantastic. One of them plays first base, one of them plays utility, you're good to go. If he doesn't turn it around, at least you've got somebody who's doing something for you. I think the answer is I would not be giving up a $31 Olsen. I guess I would trade him, right? If the right trade came along, sure, I would trade him. But if I'm competing, I would rather have that Olsen and another first baseman. But I just don't think you're going to get a Naylor or a Walker. If you can, you should.
Can I throw out there why I think Matt Olsen might be performing a little poorly this season?
Sure.
And it's maybe so simple, it's almost caveman-esque. Between the 2024, 2023, and 2022 seasons, if you count playoff games, the Braves have played a combined 427 games, playoffs and regular season. Out of those 427 games, Matt Olsen has played 427 games.
Yeah.
Guys just don't do that anymore. And so, like, he's not hitting the ball as hard and you know, his numbers are dipping a little bit. He's looking a little sluggish. Maybe that really is simply why. How many guys can say they've played 427 games since the start of the 2022 season? Probably only one.
If that's true, It'd be very interesting to see if he turns things around coming out of the All-Star break. Does
a little breather.
5 days off make a huge difference, give him a little boost. And if that does work, do the Braves then have the wherewithal to be like, hey, we know you like to play 162 games. You're sitting once a week.
Right.
We're keeping you fresh and healthy and hitting. And maybe it's not once a week, you know, maybe it's once every other week or something like that. But like, make him take some days off here and there, because if that's the issue. Now, is that the issue? I don't know. It's, you know, you look at the numbers and he's pulling the ball at a perfectly high rate. He's not hitting like a ton of pop-ups. He's just not hitting the ball as hard. Like, his max EV is down. His exit velocity is down. His hard hit rate is down. His barrel rate is down. And then, you know, you mentioned before the strikeout rate is sort of back up to some concerning numbers it's been at earlier in his career. And his walk rate is at a career low. He's chasing the most he's ever chased in his career, without swinging in the zone more than he typically has. So, like, you know, there's some weird stuff going on here. It does seem like there's some simple things that might help him, like not chasing so much. Like, if he stopped chasing as much as he is, that might be enough to make a difference. I don't know. But I find it hard to believe that Matt Olson fell off a cliff. Like, he's 30. If he were 35, we might be having a different conversation. But yeah, I'm not giving up on Matt Olson. But it doesn't hurt to, you know, have somebody else if you're trying to compete. So, all right, let's jump to our next question. As I said, we're going to talk about some first basemen. This one is less sort of a question, more a conversation that was happening on the Auto News Slack. It was started by a guy whose handle is 3IPA guy. And in addition to enjoying IPAs, he is debating if he should cut a $43 Pete Alonso. He said he has Alonso on his trade block, not getting offers. He's also not getting the deal he wants on a pricey Trey Turner. He was shopping Turner along with Aaron Nola and Spencer Steer to try to get a stud at shortstop on a good contract. That wasn't working for him. He's not getting offers on Alonso. And he led to this, like, should I just bail on a $43 Alonso? And I think there's a few things we can talk about here with, you know, how is Alonso performing? Is he worth $43? There's also some interesting strategic questions about, like, if he's not worth $43, do you just cut him? Or should you be trading him? What should you be doing? But Pete, why don't I start with you here? What would you be doing if you had a $43 Pete Alonso on a roster?
Yes. I mean, obviously, I assume this individual is out of contention. If they're looking, to just straight up cut Pete Alonso or trade Trey Turner. I mean, I am not a fan of cutting guys just for the sake of cutting them. Like, I'm not going to cut Pete Alonso just in case, you know, someone gets promoted or something, and now I want to go bid on that player. Like, if that presents itself, then sure, I'll cut him. I mean, to answer it simply, if it's the best course of action for your team because he's not a keeper, and I do not think Pete Alonso is going to be a keeper at $43 or $45, whatever he ends up being,
right?
Then sure, yeah. Like, if I saw, you know, I don't know, somebody had a $10 Junior Caminero, they're tired of waiting, they need that space, so they cut him, and you're like, I want that Junior Caminero, I need to free up the money. There's nothing wrong with cutting Pete Alonso in that situation. I don't think so. You tried trading him, nothing worked, but I'm not just going to cut him just because I'm not getting any bites on him. So there has to be a reason for it, right? I'd throw it on the trade block. Pete Alonso is available. You know, I'll cover his contract with a loan, looking to get a keepable piece in return. And if nobody sends anything and someone comes along, then sure, cut him. Otherwise, nah, I'm holding on. And I'm surprised you can't find a taker for Trey Turner. The guy can't do anything wrong. He's hitting like 400, for crying out loud.
So I think there's a couple things going on here. One is with Turner, he did specifically say he wants to package Turner, Nola, and Steer for like a cheap stud shortstop. And while I can understand the rationale for that trade from both sides, like if somebody said, yeah, I traded, I don't know, a $20 gunner for a $40 Turner, a $30 Nola, and a $10 Steer. Like, I get why somebody would do that, because you effectively get a one-for-one replacement at shortstop and upgrade two other positions, and, you know, you're fighting for a title. Totally get why a team might do that. I totally get why a team selling would want to do that. But I don't know that you're necessarily going to find that fit. I think that's too specific a thing to be shopping for. And so the couple of things I see here. One is when you're selling players, in my opinion, you cannot be that particular about what you're shopping for. When you're buying, you can, because you have to, right? Like, if you need an upgrade in the outfield and you need an on-base percentage boost in your 4x4 league, go get an outfielder with a high on-base percentage. You can't be like, oh, the best thing I can get is like a big power, low on-base middle infielder. Like, that doesn't solve your problem. So when you're shopping because you're trying to better your team, like, go get the pieces you need. When you're rebuilding, when you're buying, you know, you're selling and buying for the future, you can't be precious about what you're looking for in the return. You got to go find the best value you can get and be open to what that looks like. And the reality is that with a guy like Turner, it's probably not packaging him with Nola and Steer. It's probably just seeing what's the best package of young talent or prospects you can get for Turner on his own. The other thing, and that also then would apply to Alonso. The other thing that I think is happening here is, like you mentioned, like, you know, put him up under my block. Hey, I'm looking to sell him. I want future value. I'm willing to eat a loan, blah, 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 blah. Like, you have to be proactive about shopping your guys. Like, go to the teams that are first, second, and third in your league. See whether they need a first baseman or have room at util. If they don't, then, you know, this is a waste of time. But if they do, reach out to them. Tell them who you're interested in. Tell them that you get, you know, hey, you look like you could use a big upgrade at first base. I've got Pete Alonso available. All I'm looking for is one of these two or three prospects, you know, two or three of these prospects. Let's see if we can work something out. Because you can't count on the fact that everybody is looking at the trade block or fine. Like, I guess I'd say this is, we all have our own ways of interacting with our leagues, right? Different leagues work different ways, but even beyond the culture of a league as a whole, like, some leagues use the trade block a ton. Some don't. Some have an outside means of communication, like a Discord or a Slack channel or something. Some don't. But even within that, like, I go look at my trade blocks in my leagues pretty often and see what's there and try to make some moves and whatever. I can't assume everyone else does that too. So, like, yeah, I put Pete Alonso on my trade block. I don't know that I should be assuming that the team in second place who is, you know, running Spencer Steer out there as their first baseman and could move him to middle infield, I can't assume they've seen my trade block update. They should have. And I could argue that's what they're supposed to do, right? Like, it's how you compete is by being proactive about that stuff. But I can't assume that. And so I don't think it's sufficient or a good idea to just be like, oh, I put them on the block and I'm not getting bites. Like, go be proactive. Now, if you are being proactive and those teams are like, nah, I'm not giving you anything, then yeah, a $43 Alonso, now you start to get into a couple of different questions. One is he a keeper at $43? I think the answer is no. The other is, if I cut him at $43 and somebody else picks him up for the minimum 22 that he'll be bid at, am I handing them such a great value that it's just a mistake and I just need to eat this for the sake of the league? And that does happen sometimes. There are situations where I'm like, dude, if you cut that guy, whoever picks them up gets such a bonus. Like, I've been shopping that $60 Juan Soto in League One. If I cut $60 Juan Soto and somebody ends up with a $30 Juan Soto, like, I don't know why the rest of us bother showing up next year. Like, that's in a 4x4 league. Like, that's a league winner. So I'm not going to cut Soto. I'm just not. There's no way. If somebody picks up a $22 Alonso, and realistically, that's not what will happen. Someone will get a $27 Alonso or something like that. I don't think I'm worried about that. Is that a good value? Yeah, probably. Is that a league-changing value? No. So from that perspective, I'm not scared of cutting him. It's not a concern to me about cutting him. And so if I'm rebuilding right now, and this other thing is, right this second, Chase Burns just became available in Auto New Leagues. Travis Bezzana just became available in Auto New Leagues. Charlie Condon should become available in the next couple of days. His signing was announced, but not officially announced. Like, it's been leaked, but not announced. Like, those are some interesting prospects that it would be good to have some money to go pick up in the next couple of weeks. So yeah, I would go check out, you know, who's available at free agents, what draftees have just signed, and I would cut Alonso. I would take your immediate $21 and the $22 more you'll get later and go spend it on other stuff. But I would first take some time to actually be proactive about shopping him and seeing what the market actually is, instead of just putting him out there and hoping somebody notices. So with that, let's take a quick break. When we come back, we got one more first base question before we get into some other topics. All right, welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. Chad Young and Pete Ball going through some listener questions. And I teased it. We had three first base questions. I got one more here. Here's the last one from Icaro on Slack. Says, Freddie Freeman is $49 to $55 in all but one of my leagues. Given there's been a slight drop in production and underlying stats this year, do we start to look at him as a rental when it comes to trades? I'm gonna go first on this one. I want to just note sort of one thing, which is, yes, there has been a slight drop this year compared to, like, you know, he had a 411 WOBA last year. It's down to 379 this year. Freddie Freeman's got a career 383 WOBA. He is 34 years old. He'll be 35 before the end of the season. He's still, like I said, he has a 379 WOBA. His preseason projections were right around there. His current rest of season projections are right around there. I do think there has been a little bit of a drop in production. I don't know. You can't really argue there hasn't been. But I think Freddie Freeman's doing exactly what you should have expected him to do. Like, he's going to hit around 20, 25 home runs, which, you know, yes, he had 29 last year. He had 21 the year before that. He had 31 the year before that, but he hasn't consist. Like, the fact that the power is coming down a little bit is not crazy at this age. He's still putting up the WOBA you'd expect. The underlying stats, his walk rate is up from the last season a lot. It's up higher than it's been since 2020. And in a full non-60 game season, it's his career high, highest walk rate of his career. His strikeout rate is down from last year and below what it's been for his career. If I go look at how, you know, his quality of contact, his Statcast data, his max EV is up from last year. Now his average EV is down. His hard hit rate is down from 41.8% to 40%. The barrel rate has dropped more than that, from 11.1 down to 9.8. That's maybe the most concerning stat here. But he's got a 379 WOBA, 377X WOBA. Like, I will say this. I think that Freddie Freeman is doing exactly what you should have expected him to do, maybe with a little less power. And I don't think what he will do next year will be all that different. However, I don't think that's a $50 player anymore. Just a position and age and the fact that there's probably more decline coming because of his age, I would be content to trade him as a rental for sure. So I'm answering a question that wasn't asked by saying, I don't think it's fair to say that he's underperforming. Although I guess Icaro didn't say that. He just said there's been a decline from last year, which, yeah, I can't argue with that. I don't think he's been underperforming. I do think he is overpriced at that $50+ price point. And so, yes, I would consider him a rental in trades.
Yeah, I probably would too. I mean, this is why I love the Fangraphs roster organizer so much, because I have a $50, going to be $52 Freddie Freeman in League 13 that I currently plan on keeping. Now, that's Fangraphs points, where I think he has a little bit more value than in 5x5, and I bet most of our listeners play 5x5. And in 5x5, one of the main appeals of Freddie Freeman wasn't so much that, like, his speed just seemed to keep going up with age, and now this season it's taken a little bit of a step back. A big step back. It looks like it's going to drop off by over 50%. But it was that he's basically, like, the safest bat in baseball to hit 300. And yet, this year, he's down to 291, which may not, like, 291, you'd still take that. It's an excellent, excellent batting average. But when you consider that the last two seasons, especially, he hit 331 and 325. The year before that, he was down at 300. But the year before that, he hit 341. Like, he is a elite batting average contributor, and he's still an excellent one, a still very good one at 291, but he's not carrying you in that category like he may have in the past. And I think batting average is sometimes an overlooked category in terms of, like, him aging and, like, just general keeper conversation around Freddie Freeman. I think he's gonna age pretty well. Like, I guess this is why it would have been cool to see, you know, more information about swing speed, because, you know, his bat speed is down in the 22nd percentile, which we had a whole episode or half episode dedicated to that. You guys can go check that out. We don't know what that means, but I can't imagine that means he has a super quick swing if he's in the bottom 22% of baseball in it. You look at how he's doing against fastballs. Like, that's a thing I like to look at with when it comes to aging. I've talked about that many times in the past. Last year against fastballs, expected batting average of 344. That sounds like Freddie Freeman. This year, expected batting average against fastballs of 285. Now, the whiff rate has not changed at all, really. It was 16.7 against fastballs last year, 16.6 this year. So it's not like he's getting around slower, I guess, but the batting average, or expected batting average anyway, and batting average actually, is significantly lower against fastballs. So those places I'd look for, like, is this guy aging? I could see it, but I'm also not super concerned. I still think he's a great contributor. He's probably going to be what, a late second round pick, early third, if these numbers pan out, where let's say he gets to 30 homers and he has 8 to 10 steals with a 290 average. Actually, that'll probably be an early second rounder again. So I'm not really cooling on Freddie Freeman yet. It could come quickly, but I think he's going to age pretty well.
I think he'll age pretty well too. So this is less me saying, you know, the end is near, he might fall off a cliff. It's more just like, even aging gracefully is going to be a slow decline over time, that at his age means that, like, your expectations for this year should have been lower than they were, than what you got last year. And your expectations for next year should be a little bit lower than what you're getting this year. And at that point, yes, I do think he's a rental. So to move on to our next question, this came from Kevin Conlin on Twitter. It took him two tweets to send me this, so there's a lot of context here, so I'm trying to race through it for you here. I thought I was a favorite to win this year, but I have a ton of underperformers. J-Rod, Carroll, Simeon, Alonzo, Seager to some degree. Currently in seventh, but still thinking about trying to buy a little. But also getting old and expensive, so maybe I should be going the other way. What are your thoughts in these situations? Middle of the pack teams who should be better on paper. Ride it out, supplement, or say maybe it's just not our year and reset.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of that, I guess you can crunch the math yourself, look at the teams that are at the top, how realistic is it to catch them? I'm a bad person to ask for stuff like this because I'm very much in all my keeper leagues. If I am not going to come in first, if I'm not going to win this league, I'm selling. And that's why I love keeper league so much, because I can start playing for the next year and I want to set myself up to dominate the next season. So were I in that position? I was in that position, I guess, in the podcasters league. Now, Ronald Acuna Jr. made my decision a lot easier, obviously, and we've talked about that in the past, but I was like, I don't know, fifth or sixth place when Acuna went out, and I just immediately started selling, man. So I don't think there's any shame in it. You're going for flags fly forever. Nobody remembers who finishes in second, third, or fourth. Now, if there's financial implications and, you know, you're trying to catch absolutely third place insane to make some money, then do the math. Like, if you think you got a chance, like, he listed those players. Those are good players. I'm expecting good second halves from Marcus Semien, who I bought in a league, from Corey Seager, who I think he's already back. I think he's been fine. Yeah. The only one I'm concerned about is Corbin Carroll. I don't know what the heck's going on there, but I think even J-Rod is going to start crushing the ball. Like, he's done this before. J-Rod has a little bit of that, like, early Joe Ram in him, where it's like, for stretches, it's like, what the heck is wrong with this guy? And then quickly he reminds you he's one of the best players in baseball. So I still expect that to happen for him. So if there are financial implications, if you can get to third and cash out or something, then yeah, obviously go for it, man. But if this is for fun, if this is for, you know, bragging rights, start looking to next year.
Yeah, I think that's the first question is what you were just talking about, which is, like, figure out what matters to you. Are you, like, you know, if you fight back and get to third, is that a win? Or is that just like, now I got third and I mortgaged my future to do it? And yeah, because, like, I'll give you an example here. My team in League One, which we talked about in last week's episode, I am in seventh place, same situation. I thought my team could compete this year. But I am in seventh place. Now, for me, it's been less the offense, which I've actually got either the best or second best offense. I think I now have the second best offense in that league, but I've had the best or second best offense most of the year. But my pitching, like, we talked about Pablo Lopez, he's been a disaster. I had Joe Musgrove on that team, he's been a disaster. Carlos Rodon, he has not been as good as I hoped he would be. Gavin Williams has only thrown 14 innings so far. Yeah, I could keep going. It's been a disaster on the pitching front. So what I did before I made the decision I was selling is I went and I looked at the standings and I said, all right, I'm in seventh place. I have 49 points. That league pays out the top four. And I wanted to get into that top four. I needed 15 points to get there. Now, 15 points is a lot in a 4x4 league, but I am right now at 1 point each for home runs per nine, ERA, and whip, which is what happens when all of your pitchers are disappointing and terrible. But I think a lot of those pitchers could bounce back and have good second halves, and Gavin Williams is back. I also have Connor Crawford, who hasn't been disappointing and I've been very happy with. I just picked up Luis Ortiz. I've got Kodai Senga, who may or may not come back at some point. Like, there's some possibilities here. However, I am 800 innings in to a, 1,500 inning limit. So I've gone 55-ish percent, whatever that is, of my innings. My home run per nine is a 1.29. 1.296, actually. 1.296. If I put up a home run per nine of one the rest of the way, which would be third best in this league. So I go from being the worst in the league by a lot to being one of the best in this league the rest of the way. I should pick up one or maybe 2 points in home run per nine. In ERA, the math is even worse. Whip, it's pretty similar. So there is a possibility that if I go from having terrible pitching to elite pitching, I could pick up 6-7 points. That 6 or 7 points gets me to fifth, maybe. That's a best case scenario, I think. I'm not willing to buy to try to get back to, fifth, sixth place. Like, that's not the goal here. The goal here is to be in the top four. I'm just too far away in pitching. Now, if I had gone here and said, oh, look, the lowest ERA besides me. So in this league, my ERA is 4.61. The next worst ERA is 4.10. Like, it's a huge gap. Jesus. If I were at 4.11 and I thought, hey, if I put up an ERA of like 3.2 the rest of the way, I could get down to like 3.6 and pick up 5 points in ERA, I'd be buying, I think. Because I'd be close enough to say like, hey, I think I've got the pieces that I can make this run. But I don't. And it's just too far away. So that, Kevin, I think is what you need to do is you need to be, there isn't a general answer here of like, oh, in those situations I buy, in those situations I sell. Like, in those situations I stop, I look at what's going on. I make some assumptions of like, all right, let's assume my team plays as well in the second half as I thought they would have in the first half. Remembering that the half is not half, it's only like 40% of the season. So given that context, can you make up the gap? And if you can, I would buy. Go for it. And if you can't, I would sell. That's my answer.
Yeah, I agree with that.
So let's jump to our next question. This one comes from DBlue on Slack, who asked, how do you guys balance projections versus what you see? For example, in the offseason, surplus calculators rated MJ Melendez highly compared to past performance and put a double-digit value on him. Yet he has been the same player he always is, or worse. This ended up leading to a whole conversation about like looking at rest of season projections and how you balance projections versus what somebody's actually doing in season. And I think it's just an interesting question of like, how do you balance those things? How do you think about projections versus like the stats they're actually putting up?
Yeah, I'm such a, I think this is the second time I'm saying this in this podcast, so that's not great, but especially for a mailbag episode, I'm not a great person to ask for this because I'm just not a huge projections person to begin with, to be honest with you. I enjoy looking at projections before the season. I think they're interesting. They're extremely well thought out, and there are some that tend to obviously do a lot better than others. I like ones that are kind of aggregators too. I know that's, which one is that? ATC,
Yeah,
looks at projections from all these different places and puts different weights on them. Anyway, that's kind of besides the point. I get why people use them, but baseball is just such an unpredictable sport. And like once we're in the thick of it and I have my own data to look at, I like to make my own decisions for better or worse. And sometimes that's for worse and I'll wear that. But I don't really look at projections that much. I guess that's kind of the gist of my answer here. Instead, I look at what a player has done and I understand what stats kind of show like here's what's been done and here's maybe what should have happened. And I look at the player, I look at the underlying data and I just kind of make a decision. I guess for me, and I understand if this is different for other people, if I just look at projections and just go by what projections say, I don't know why I'm playing. So like, I like to make these decisions myself and, I'm not a huge, projections guy. Definitely not the answer he was looking for, but that's where I'm at with that.
So I am a projections guy, and I'll talk a little about where I use them and where I break away from them. But I do want to talk a little bit about Melendez just for a moment, because I think it's an important example of why I trust projections. So we could say Melendez is underperforming his projections, but his projections for strikeout rate were all around 26%. He's striking out about 26%. He is striking out 26% of the time. His walk rate is 7.3%. The projections for his walk rate were more like 10 to 11%. So that is down. His ISO is 192. His projections for ISO, 194, 188, 194, 207, 207, 195, 201, all right in that range. The thing that's massively different from his projections is that all of his projections were for a league average-ish BAPIP, and he has a 223 BAPIP. That is most of what is driving the shortfall from Melendez. The walk rate's a problem too, for sure. Now, whether you want to buy into that walk, you know, the walk rate bouncing back, the BAPIP bouncing back, like, he's actually posting a home run per fly ball rate above his career levels. Like, there's some positive stuff going on under the hood. One other thing to note is his projected WOBAs were 321, 325, 330. He's got a 320x WOBA. Like, he is very much performing in line with what the projections thought. Now, the reason I mention this is not to say, like, oh, you're wrong to be down on Melendez. Like, you can be down on Melendez. I have no strong feelings about that. My point is more that we are really good as a species of animal. Humans are really good at finding patterns where we want to find patterns, even when they don't exist. And the projections and the computers are really good at calling us on that. And, like, I actually think if you look at Melendez's projections, they're good. This isn't a case of projections missing badly. This is a case of projections being pretty accurate and the results haven't followed the performance, which we see happen all the time. To me, Melendez is a buy low. The projections are still in the same spot they were before the season. There's still pretty good expectations for him to bounce back. They match his X stats. Like, there's all a lot of good there. So my point on this is I tend to trust projections because they're smarter than I am. The computers are better at this than I am. What I am looking for, though, are cases where I can break away from the projections intelligently. And there's a few things that can go into that. One is, if there isn't, like, projections can sometimes be aware of injuries if there's, like, missed games and stuff. But if someone's been playing through an injury, the projections don't necessarily have a good way of understanding that. And so, or if a player made a swing change, or if a player made some other adjustment, if they were asked to move positions, like, there's lots of things that could happen to a player that the projections don't necessarily know. They can't account for those things. So, like, a guy makes a swing change, and, you know, an example of this is early in the season, there was a lot of talk from the Guardians, and this is one of those things that, like, the beauty of watching the games, right? Like, there was a lot of talk from the Guardians about how Bo Naylor was having better at bats. He looked better. He had been making some adjustments in the offseason. Those adjustments, he just needed time to let those adjustments come together. And they were really impressed with him being patient, taking his time, trying to find some results. And it started to come together for him. The projections don't necessarily know that he made those kind of adjustments and that he needed to, you know, he was waiting for stuff to come together. But since May 25th is just sort of an arbitrary date, he has a 107 WRC plus. Like, he has actually turned things around quite a bit. It's even better if you go a week later or a couple weeks later, I guess. Since June 11th, last month plus, Bo Naylor is a 127 WRC plus. So that's a case where, like, I don't think the projections were going to be able to see that turnaround coming. And so I am looking for cases where I think I know something the projections don't know. But if I'm going to disagree with a projection, it has to be because I think I know something the projections don't know. The other thing that is true about projections, somebody made a comment in this conversation in Slack about how the projections are going to be slow to react to changes. I think that's sort of true, but it's going to be true because being slow to react is probably the correct decision. The problem is that from a fantasy perspective, if you're slow to react, you miss these guys, right? Like
that somebody right is good. Is my number one reason. I think why I don't bother with projections in season that much. It's just,
so it's hard to adjust. I still like them in season because if you start to see a guy's in season projection changing, to me, if like, if I see a guy, I'm like, wow, this guy's performing really well. And I'm like, whoa, his projection's getting a lot better. Like then I'm really excited. If I see a guy is performing better and his projection isn't moving, but I really believe in something that's changed, then I'm going to take a shot at him because eventually the projection will catch up or the guy will fall back to earth. And so I actually, one of the things I do is I watch those projections after I take a stab at a guy, right? I'm like, okay, I think like David Fry early in the season looked great. I jumped on him in a couple places. I've been very happy to have him. His projection started getting better. And so as his projection started getting better, I was like, okay, now I really believe, right? Like I took the chance because if I waited to take the chance, it would have been too late. So I didn't want to wait to take the chance. But having taken the chance, the projections are validating whether I should continue with that experiment or jump ship. So I think in season, that's sort of how I use projections is like, how do I validate? Like, you know, again, talking about Fry, like he's gone through this rough stretch. So far, I'm sticking with him through this rough stretch because the projections still look better than they did before. And so there's some reason to believe that he actually made some meaningful changes that are worth investing in. But yeah, I think you have to go on.
No, I think all that's fair. And I like how you added some nuance to it. And I don't mean to come across so like anti-projections, right? Like that'd be like arguing like, no, if we went to robot umpires, more calls would be wrong. Although I know there were some issues with that in the minor leagues, but it's like, it's just not true. Like the computer is going to be right. I don't want to speak about something I don't know that much about because I don't use it because it just isn't, I wouldn't get as much joy out of it. And I know that if that one time where I'm like, all right, I'm going to trust the systems and drop this player or something like that. And then that player went off. Like I would never be able to live that down. So I totally see the merits of it. I think the way you use it is efficient and smart. And especially in a rotisserie league where like it is something that you can kind of project out and it's just total numbers at the end of the year. And, you know, do I have enough of this, enough of that? Well, the computer says I does. So here I go. I play a lot of head to head. So like those projections don't help as much, you know, but the way you described it, that makes total sense to me.
Yeah. And I think that also brings up another point, though, the last thing you said, which is like for any of these things, and I'm going to say this is an overriding statement for like any advice I give on any channel I talk on, any podcast I'm on, any articles I write, like do what you think is fun. Like the game is supposed to be fun. So if like using projections is fun, use them. And if it's not fun, don't. And if you're not sure if it's fun or not, then you can come to me and say like, hey, how do you use these? How should I think about them and take my advice or not? But like at the end of the day, you should just, you know, it's a game and it should be fun. So like, if you like using projections, use them. And if you don't, don't. My personal take is I prefer to use them but find opportunities to go against them and try to be aggressive at buying even before the projections are ready to buy, but then use the projections later to validate that I made a good decision, that I shouldn't bail on the guy, things like that. So let's take one more quick break. When we come back, we got two final questions to get to. All right. Welcome back to the Keeper Cup podcast. We are, you know, we made a comment at the beginning that we had 7 questions to get to, and Pete was like, oh, we can get to 10. It's been almost 50 minutes.
And we haven't gotten to our 7 more yet.
So we had a question following up on that conversation that we just had about projections and stuff. Drew on Slack asked, adding to that, how do you think about and value X stats when determining player value and who to go after? Now, I think that's also an interesting one. And I know you do look at X stats. So you can't punt on this one, Pete.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of a lot of expected stats are basically based on like what has happened and here's where they should be, right? Like your expected batting average is based on all sorts of things like exit velocity, launch angle, and all that stuff. So I've heard analysts before talk about how like don't put too much stock in that because that's not what's going to happen. That's just based on what has happened. But like, I still find that very important because in my experience, oftentimes when you have a large sample of stuff that has already happened, that is probably going to continue to happen. So I mean, yeah, there's no doubt about it. I do love expected stats, but X stats is a really, that's an umbrella term for a lot of different statistics that, you know, some I feel more passionately about than others. So if we just wanted to open this up to like stats and what do I look at, what do I care the most about? I think for hitters, it's barrel rate, it's strikeout rate, it's exit velocity, it's pull rate, and it's fly ball rate. Like those things I look at all the time. I don't think anything I just mentioned is an X stat. Did I mention expected statistic there? No, I don't think so. The one that you've really turned me on to is comparing WOBA to expected WOBA to kind of look at maybe like who are some guys who have maybe been a little bit unlucky in underperforming their expected WOBA. But then making sure, like we kind of talked about with Matt Olson earlier in the episode, like if even if they're underperforming it, like is their expected WOBA actually good or is it still pretty poor? So I do like expected stats. I like diving into them and making my own projections to kind of go back to that term. But I don't find them to be the most important statistics for either hitters or pitchers. I do think things like FIP and expected FIP and expected ERA, although it maybe takes into exit velocity a little bit too much, I think those are extremely helpful for me as I determine which players, again, I guess we're talking about pitchers now, have been unlucky or maybe a little bit lucky relative to the rest of the pack, but they're based on things that have already happened. And you've got to know your players and look at workloads and injury histories and swing changes and all those kinds of things to, you know, get the entire picture. So I don't think it's relying just on projections. I don't think it's relying just on expected statistics or just on my, you know, barrel rate, K rate, et cetera formula. Instead, it's looking at the whole picture and making decisions that are best for your team.
Yeah, I think that's all right. And I think the stats that you listed and, you know, barrel rate, strikeout rate, I also like walk rate, pull rate and fly ball rate. Like those are all things that I look at before I just look at X stats.
Yeah.
One of the things though that I am more and more realizing with X stats is just as like, you know, the reason, part of the reason that X stats are not predictive is because you get all sorts of weird things that can happen, such as having a really high XWOBA on lightly hit looping pop-up-y liners that are hit just hard enough to get over the infield. And like that, those are great, right? You know that those are gonna have like, those are a high X batting average because they fall into no man's land. And that just, that happens consistently. It is not a skill that I want to bank on repeating. Like if you show me a guy who consistently hits little bloopers, you know, for a month, hits a bunch of little bloop singles, I'm not like, yeah, that guy is, that's a guy I want to go pick up. Look how good his XWOBA is. Cause like those, that's just not a sustainable way to be a successful player. The other thing is that these X stats are still relatively new and there's different ways of calculating them. And so like an example that came up, I wrote a little bit about pulling the ball and in that article, it was over at Fangraphs. It's, I think, a pretty good piece. So you should go check it out. But in that article, I talked about Lawrence Butler. And one of the things I mentioned with Lawrence Butler is if you go to his Fangraphs page, you go to Baseball Savant, you look and it's, he's got a 299 WOBA and a 331 XWOBA. Seems like a guy who's really underperforming. If you go to pitcher list, you'll see that he has a 299 WOBA and a 294 XWOBA. Now, why are those numbers so different? It's because it's a different calculation of XWOBA. And pitcher list includes batted ball direction in theirs. I don't know if there's other differences. But batted ball direction matters a lot. The reason I brought this up is because it was an article that I was writing about pulling the ball and going the other way. And the reality is that like, that 331 or whatever it was XWOBA for Butler is not a good measure of what he's done because he's hitting the ball the other way way too much. And so his batted balls are not as valuable as they seem, because when you hit the ball hard the other way, you underperform XWHIP. And when you pull the ball hard, you overperform XWHIP. We've talked about this a lot on the show. We call it the Isaac Paredes conversation if you want, but it applies here in the opposite direction to Lawrence Butler. And so I don't like to get too, like, I like to use X stats, and XWOBA is my preferred of those stats. I like to use XWOBA as a starting point to be like, huh, that guy's underperforming or that guy's overperforming. Why? And then I want to dig in, and that's where I want to look at, like, what is his pull rate? Like, because I will say, like, I looked at Butler early in the season because his XWOBA was so high, and I just couldn't figure out, like, he wasn't pulling the ball. Yes, he hit the ball hard, but like, there just wasn't a lot to get excited about, I didn't think. And then you go look at the pitcherless XWOBA, and it's like, oh, well, that explains it. Like, his batted balls are not as valuable as StatCast, as the Baseball Savant XWOBA thinks they are, because he's hitting them the wrong direction. So I am still at a point with any of these stats, and like, you know, bat speed, all this bat speed stuff to me is like another level where, like, I'm not even looking at that right now. We had a whole episode about it, as you mentioned. It was fascinating. And now I'm just waiting. I'm not touching it because, like, I don't know. I think people are making pronouncements about how to use this stuff that we don't really have enough data to know. And I'm not convinced that XWOBA has really moved out of that category. I like to use it. I think it's interesting, but there's so many other things that go into it, and batted ball direction being one example of that. So I would rather look at the, you know, maybe use it as a starting point, but look at the underlying numbers whenever possible. So our final question, this came from Kenny on Slack, and this, I can answer this one, I think, sort of quickly, and then Pete, you can add stuff in. But he says, at some point, can you delve into the delicate end of season timing in Auto-New? When to cut someone but not allow them to be claimed? When to cut but not allow a re-auction? What guys are good to cut bait with going into the roster freeze? Which guys are good to go into the offseason with on your roster? So start just from a purely logistic standpoint. Auctions stop happening 48 hours before the end of the season, basically, which is typically means they stop Friday night. Auctions will run through that Sunday night that the season ends. Even though the games are over, auctions will run through the end of the day that Sunday. So you have until, I think, midnight Eastern time, basically, on Friday night, October, whatever, you know, the last Friday of the season, to start auctions. What that means is anybody you cut after Thursday night at midnight, I guess Thursday at 11:59 p.m., whatever, cannot be auctioned by someone else. Because by the time they clear waivers, auctions will have been cut off. So that's sort of the logistical piece here, right? If you cut somebody before that Thursday, they can be auctioned again, or even on that Thursday. If you cut someone on that Friday or later, they can't be re-auctioned. If you cut someone on Saturday, they can still be waiver claimed through the end of the day Sunday. But if you cut someone Sunday, the waiver claim won't process before the season ends. And so they can't be claimed. So that's sort of the logistics of it. Now, in terms of how to think about using that, you know, we talked about this a little bit with Pete Alonso, right? I was saying how with Pete Alonso, like, you have to decide if cutting him, like, first of all, is he a keeper at $43? And if not, is he so valuable at $21 that by cutting him, you're handing him to someone else in a way you don't want to? I make those same decisions at the end of the season. And I have guys who I'm like, look, if I cut this guy, I don't want this guy on my roster in the offseason, but if I cut him on Thursday and somebody starts an auction for him on Friday, they could get a great value. So I'm just going to wait till Friday and I'll cut them Friday. If somebody wants to waiver claim my $43 Pete Alonso, go for it. Have fun. But I don't, doesn't matter to me. In fact, I actually try to cut those guys on Thursday, because if they get waiver claimed on Friday, then that team has to make cuts to clear cap for that player. And I can waiver claim their cuts potentially if they cut someone interesting. But yeah, if it's a guy like Soto, like, let's say I'm unable to trade Soto and then decide I'm cutting him. That's not a decision I'm going to make. I'm going to keep a $60 Soto if he's still on my roster at that point. But let's assume I wasn't going to keep him. I don't want him to go for $30. So I would not cut him until Friday or Saturday. Like, make it late enough. Again, if somebody wants to waiver claim him, fine. But I don't want him to get picked up in an auction. Then Alonso, I may not care as much. So you've got to make those decisions, like, who is so good and so close to a fair price that getting them for half price is a steal, in which case you wait until later to cut them, or who do you not care if people re-auction? And if there's somebody that you're like, I don't even want anyone to claim this guy, you wait till Sunday to cut them. You don't cut them before Sunday, which then gets into this question of who are guys you want to cut bait with versus who you want on your roster. So the guys I'm going to cut bait with there are basically anybody who I think is not only not a cut for me, but it's just obviously not, or so he's not a keep for me, but it's obviously not a cut keep for anybody. And so in those that last weekend of the season, those final hours of the season, when I can cut someone knowing that nobody else can pick them up, I'm going to cut guys who I don't want to keep, I don't think anybody would trade for, and I'm going to pick up guys who either I think might have trade value, who I might want to keep, or who I think something could theoretically happen in the offseason to meaningfully change their value. So I'm trying to think of a good example of somebody who the offseason could really move their value. It's a challenging one to think about right now. It's something that comes up more later. But
potential closers definitely would come to mind, like a Ben Joyce or an AJ Puck, someone like that.
Yeah, I think that's a good example. I think actually going back a year in the other direction, Reynaldo Lopez is an interesting one. If you had thought ahead of time, like, maybe he'll become a starter next year. I honestly, I don't know why you would have thought that. It never occurred to me that that might happen. But if you had some insight that that might happen, pick him up. Because he's the kind of guy who, if he becomes a starter, all of a sudden maybe his value does meaningfully change. And sure enough, that's what's happened. A player who plays in a park that is bad for them, a pitcher at Coors, a hitter at Safe or at T-Mobile. I call it Safeco. I don't even think it's been Safeco since I've been here. But a hitter at T-Mobile, a pitcher at Coors, who you think might get traded. Right now, if they're a free agent, yeah, you could jump at that. But that there's more expectation. Other people will be aware of that. But if you're like, I don't know, I think that, you know, Kyle Freeland might finally get out of Colorado and have more value. I think you're wrong. I don't think he would have more value. But if you thought that, like, go pick that guy up, because you're trying to find guys who you think are either keepers, have trade value, or who could be more valuable in January than they are in October. It is hard to figure out who that last group of guys are. There have been cases before I've been like, you know what? I'm going to trade for this guy because he's, you know, a prospect pitcher who's on the verge of a promotion. And by January, it may appear that he's in the rotation. Stuff like that.
I think that whole conversation is probably worth a half of an episode at the end of the season. But
yeah,
probably something we can better handle then with more specific examples.
But Kenny, I at least gave you some basics for now. So Pete, we got through our seven questions. I hope you didn't come up with three more because it's been over an hour. And I think you're still recovering from COVID. This is like a marathon for you. I'm very impressed.
Oh, well, thank you. I am. What's not helping me get over it is the fact that my opponent has hit. We only start 10 hitters a night and he has 16 home runs through 7 days or 8 days of games, whatever this has been now. So that is not helping me get through this, but recording
matchup's almost over. You'll get a new week soon.
Oh, it's just awful.
All right. Well, thank you all for listening. Thank you for your questions. Hope you enjoy the answers, and we'll be back with you next week.